Welcome to another episode of the Left of Lansing podcast with Pat Johnston. A progressive insight into Michigan's political and cultural world. And of course, an entertaining podcast designed to shine a light on how to make Michigan's political machine work for the people. Now, from the Left of Lansing headquarters, located in his attic, here's the award-winning Pat Johnston.
Our investigation has uncovered evidence that Lee Chatfield used various different schemes to embezzle, steal, and convert both private and public monies to fund a lavish lifestyle that a state salary could not possibly afford. This included luxury shopping, fine dining, and extended vacations in swanky hotels in various exotic locations.
Aw, yeah. Welcome to another installment of Michigan's premier progressive podcast. I am Pat Johnston, and I feel like it's becoming a weekly trend where we are spending time on another episode talking about another aspect of the Michigan Republican crime syndicate. And yes, I wanted Michigan Attorney General Dana Nessel's voice leading this week's episode because she and her office made some big news this week. As you heard, the Attorney General announced her office has filed charges against former Republican State House Speaker Lee Chatfield and his wife, Stephanie Chatfield. Isn't that nice? Now, this investigation started as a look into allegations of sexual assault and financial wrongdoing by Lee Chatfield. And according to Kyle Davidson from Michigan Advance, Lee Chatfield faces 13 counts, including charges of conducting a criminal enterprise, embezzlement, and a violation of the Charitable Trust Act. Stephanie Chatfield faces two counts, embezzlement from a nonprofit organization and conspiracy to commit embezzlement from a nonprofit organization. But, you know, how can this be? How can this be? This is the Law and Order Party, or so I'm told. I mean, it's always, always the projection with them, isn't it? As Davidson reports in Michigan Advance, Michigan State Police began investigating Chatfield after his sister-in-law, Rebecca Chatfield, told authorities that Lee Chatfield sexually assaulted her for more than a decade. Assaults which began when she was just 14 or 15 years old. Nessel's office then took over that investigation in 2022, but then expanded that investigation to also include allegations of Lee's misappropriating funds. Now, Attorney General Nessel did not issue any charges related to the sexual assault allegations, citing not enough evidence, and maybe that's because so much time has passed or some other variables we just don't know exactly. But can you just imagine if sexual assault charges against current Democratic State House Speaker Joe Tate surfaced, charges which included allegations that he sexually assaulted someone, or let's just put it in Lee Chatfield's terms, that he sexually assaulted his sister-in-law when she was just 15 or 16 years old? Can you just imagine? Seriously, can you imagine if the same charges were levied against any Democrat in the State House? The right wing would be all over this, charging Democrats with being groomers. But as we've seen with former U.S. House Speaker Dennis Hastert, who was called a serial child molester by a federal judge and who spent 15 months in jail for evading bank laws as he was paying hush money to a former victim, it seems like many so-called pro-family right-wing Republicans are kind of the ones doing the grooming, or at least are accused of it more often than not. I mean, the right wing yells and yells that progressives are grooming kids because of a book in a library. But they're the actual ones either getting caught or at least being accused of said grooming. It's always, always the projection. Now, getting back to the Michigan Advance story, let me just read one more paragraph, if you don't mind. Through the investigation, Nessel said they discovered Lee Chatfield had used a 501c4 social welfare organization, the Peninsula Fund, to pay off his personal charges on credit cards, utilized a kickback scheme from his political action committees, and received improper mileage reimbursements from state monies for trips he did not take. And she also alleged that Chatfield used the money from the Peninsula Fund to rent and sublet an apartment, pocketing the money from the sublease. Oh, man. I mean, this guy used government, used his power, used his position to enrich himself and his family. but he never once thought about using government to help his constituents and to help fellow Michiganders. Not once. And as Nestle said during that press conference, the Chatfields converted that Peninsula Fund money for their own personal use. And Stephanie Chatfield's job was apparently to act like, I don't know, like a de facto accountant. She'd make the payments from that fund and then make sure that everything balanced out. Nestle also charged two former Chatfield aides with several felonies in December, including embezzlement, criminal enterprise, and filing a false tax return. The individuals, Robert and Ann Menard, have pleaded not guilty, according to Michigan Advance. I mean, this is today's Michigan Republican Party, everyone. And they're following in the footsteps of Dear Leader, who's currently in court facing criminal charges that he paid a former adult actress, Stormy Daniels, that he paid her money to keep quiet about her allegations that she, unfortunately, had a sexual encounter with Dear Leader. Ugh. But the crime that he's being accused of doing is that he gave money to his former lawyer, Michael Cohen, who then gave that money to Ms. Daniels. Ah, now you're saying, what's wrong with that? Prosecutors say that the money given to Cohen was falsely logged as, quote-unquote, legal expenses. You see, it was used as a scheme to bury these allegations from ever seeing the light of day, which could alter the outcome of an election. And by the way, didn't Lee Chatfield join former Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirky on that trip to Washington, D.C., where they met with Dear Leader as he was trying to overturn the election here in Michigan in 2020? Law and order. Oh, and before you forget, these charges against Lee Chatfield are happening just 1 year after another former Republican State House Speaker Rick Johnson was charged for taking bribes as chairman of the state's Medical Marijuana Licensing Board. Again, this is your law and order party. Again, this is your pro-family party. It's always, always, always the projection. Don't forget that. Now, you know, one part of Dana Nestle's press conference that is getting attention is the part where she called on greater transparency in our state government and how it's so desperately needed.
This case and the other major cases we've announced have all highlighted the many ways Michigan's current campaign finance and disclosure laws are inept and make concealing enormous amounts of fundraising and spending far too easy.
Nestle and Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson are each appearing in front of a State House Ethics Committee this week, where they will announce their backing of legislation requiring a one-year moratorium preventing lawmakers from leaving office so that they can just pack up and quickly join up with some lobbying firm. You know, so that way they can just make some good cash right after leaving office. This is otherwise known as a cooling off period, and it's something that we really need. Now, Democrats just regained their two-seat majority in the state house again this week with the victories of Peter Herzberg and May Song, who won their special elections. So it's time for Democrats to be bold and pass so many bills that we've been talking about here on this podcast this year, and that includes the Bringing Reforms and Integrity, Transparency, and Ethics Act, otherwise known as the BRITE Act. This would force lawmakers to, among many things, disclose gifts from lobbyists and donors, and that their staffs would also be under those same kinds of rules. I can't believe we don't even have those rules already in effect in this state. It's time, because as we've seen, some lawmakers just can't abide by the law. Remember, these are the same people who get wined and dined and get connected with all kinds of people and all kinds of money and gifts, while some of them work hard at the same time to deny helping people to just get a little help to make some ends meet. It's all about equal opportunity, and some of these lawmakers are cashing in for themselves while cashing out on hard-working Michiganders. Now, I've talked with many progressive activists and politicians here who've talked about a compassion economy or just trying to find ways to make things a bit more fair for some people who don't have the resources to get wined and dined and coddled by lobbyists. These are the hard-working Michiganders who can't afford the money to have corporate lobbyists speak for them in Lansing. Now, with Democrats in control of the state trifecta, they've made some significant strides in trying to address the daily needs and concerns of everyday Michiganders. But there's something happening in Flint that's serving, I think, as a blueprint of that kind of compassion economy, an economy that trickles up rather than trickling down. There's a new program which started in Flint this past January called the RX Kids Program. Now, I brought it up here before, and I'm excited to see how this all works out. The RX Kid program provides all pregnant mothers in Flint a one-time $1,500 payment after 20 weeks of pregnancy, and then $500 a month for the infant's first year. No strings attached, no means testing, no income requirements. That's it. It's just a way to help people in a city that's been devastated by both corporate greed and government abuse and malfeasance. The funding is coming from a mix of public and private financing, and Governor Whitmer has included money for this program in her 2025 budget proposal in the hopes of being able to expand this kind of program across other areas of the state, both urban and rural areas. You see, this is the kind of thinking we need, and it makes common sense because studies show how this kind of investment in people is working in other countries. It is common sense, everyone. Coming up to talk more about the RX Kids program is Dr. H. Luke Schaefer, who is the co-director of this wonderful and common sense program. You see, this is the kind of common sense, progressive thinking we need to happen more in the state and throughout the country. And while some are trying to take away opportunity while ensuring they get paid by some rich lobbyists, the RX Kids program is trying to expand opportunity. Dr. H. Luke Schaefer is coming right up. Let me say a quick thanks to my good friend Rich for everything he's done to make leftoflansing.com an awesome site. You're listening to LOL.
It's the Left of Lansing podcast. If you truly want to get Pat fired up, talk about Tigers baseball or how you think the 90s produced the worst music of any decade. You've been warned. Email him at leftoflansing@gmail.com and follow him on Twitter at leftoflansing. Here's Pat.
Let me say another quick thank you to our show voice, Jessica, for all of her help on making the show sound better and more professional. And like she said, if you ever need to get a hold of me, just email me. That's leftoflansing@gmail.com or find me on X or Twitter. And my handle there is leftoflansing. All right. I've been looking forward to talking about this new program that's happening in Flint, which is groundbreaking, which is compassionate, and just basically makes all kinds of common sense. A couple of months ago, mothers in Flint, Michigan could begin enrolling in the RX Kids program. Now, you've heard me talk about this program before here, but in case you haven't, RX Kids is a no strings attached program for pregnant mothers and their babies in which they get money during the pregnancy and then for the baby's first year. Of course, Flint has gone through so much of which is not the fault of the people who lived there, like the Flint water crisis, of course, from a decade ago, which is unreal to think that it's already been a decade ago. So joining me to talk more about this initiative and further details, Dr. H. Luke Schaefer. Dr. Schaefer is a professor of social justice, social policy, and public policy, and is also the director of the University of Michigan's Poverty Solutions Initiative, and is also the co-director of RX Kids. Dr. Schaefer, thank you so much for taking time out of your swamp schedule here to talk with me for a few minutes here this week. I greatly appreciate it.
Such a pleasure. Thanks for the invite.
All right. Well, let's get right into it here and talk about RX Kids first. Well, let's have you maybe just talk about what RX Kids in Flint is all about and what it's really trying to ultimately accomplish.
Yeah, I mean, this is the project in my professional career that's brought me the most joy. It builds on a huge amount of evidence from all over the world. So many different countries have programs that say, you know what, raising kids is expensive. And society has a reason to come alongside parents in that really hard work. In one way to do it, one, you know, efficient, simple, and empowering way to do it is to provide money to say, hey, parents, you know what your kids need the most. You know what your family needs the most. And so we're going to provide really usually a modest amount of money to buy diapers or pay the rent or buy books or school supplies to really use to empower your families to live the lives that they want to live to their potential. And every time countries do this, we see child poverty just plummet. We see food hardship plummet, and we see kids and families do better. And we dabbled in this in the United States with the expanded child tax credit. It was a program that was built on this very same logic in 2021. Virtually all families across the nation got $250 per child, $300 for young children for 6 months at the end of 2021. And you know what we saw? We saw child poverty fall to the lowest level ever recorded in history in the United States. Millions of kids lifted out of poverty. We saw food hardship fall to the lowest level ever recorded. We saw things like credit scores improve to the highest that we'd ever seen. So it was a resounding success. And it was also part of ushering in a period of incredibly rapid job growth where more and more people were working, and we pulled ourselves out of the COVID recession. So that program wasn't extended, and that was heartbreaking for those of us who are following the work.
Mm-hmm.
But then I got this incredible call from Dr. Mona Hanna Atisha, who turned the tide on the Flint water crisis with her incredibly important work, who had been talking to parents who were reflecting on how hard it is to raise kids these days. And so we got together, building on the advisory groups that she had been talking to, looked at the evidence, looked at the numbers, and decided it would be awesome to do a child benefit for all kids in Flint. Those numbers got really big really quickly. And that sort of funneled us down into the first year of life. So that very first year of life is so fundamentally important to the life trajectory of families. So much development goes on. And so this is a program in the city of Flint that's available to all families who are expecting or have a new baby. So expectant moms can receive a $1,500 payment during pregnancy to pay for all of those expenses, maybe keep them in the same household, you know, keep their residential stability going, pay for food, pay for all of those expenses of having a baby, and then $500 a month till their infant reaches 1 year old. So in the city of Flint, we are going to eradicate deep poverty among families with infants.
I was going to ask you exactly how did you get involved in this whole program, but you said that Dr. Hanna Atisha, she contacted you?
Yeah, that's right. So I wrote a book many years ago called $2 a Day, which was about very, very, very poor families in the United States. And as a result of that book that got some attention, I got to be a part of designing the expanded child tax credit. It was a proposal that incredible champions took up in Congress. A lot of people, when we just started out, thought it was pie in the sky. It could never happen in the United States, but it continued to get support. And so then when candidate Biden was looking for something extra to do for families during COVID, he grabbed that proposal that was the American Family Act in Congress and put it into his American Rescue Plan. And so the best day of my professional life up to that point was when that program rolled out in 2021. And you know, more than 60 million kids started getting that benefit.
Yep.
And then the worst day was when it wasn't extended. And so we saw that we could just cause child poverty to plummet. And then as a country, we decided, you know what, we're going to go back to more child poverty. We're going to go back to millions of more children in poverty. So I was sort of a little bit at a loss in figuring out what was I going to do next. And that's when I heard from Mona.
How many families are you hoping that this program will help here maybe in the first year? Like how many do you think that this could really, really, really make an impact on?
So one of the parts of the design of ARCS Kids is that it's a universal program. In the United States, we historically like to have programs for poor families, programs for middle-class families, maybe programs for wealthy families. And, you know, someone once said programs for poor families are poor programs. They often involve a lot of stigma, and they often are sort of imbued with racist stereotypes that then drive policymaking. And so this takes a different approach to say, we're going to make this a program for all the families, because families well above poverty are still struggling with the costs of diapers and childcare and all the incredible expenses of raising a kid. A lot of the research is showing, actually, when you make a program more universal, it actually serves low-income families more effectively. Lower-income families are more likely to take up a program that's available to everyone, maybe because of the stigma that is a different set of messages, maybe because it's simpler to understand. They don't have to wonder, you know, am I below the eligibility line? Am I above it? But in any event, we hope to reach every family in the city of Flint. So another interesting nerdy thing that your listeners might be interested in is we often struggle with getting the counts right of different age groups, like how many kids are out there, how many adults are there in a community. We know with a lot of precision how many infants there are because of vital records, because virtually everybody gets a birth certificate who's born in the United States. So we can look back from the past couple of years and see that there's, over the last couple of years, there's somewhere between 900 and 1,200 babies born in Flint every year. Over 75% of them have Medicaid coverage. So that suggests that they're low income, you know, might be above the poverty line, but still low income. And the incredible thing that we've seen so far is that we just started at the very beginning of January of this year. So we're just a couple months in, and we are already at like 90% take up or 90% saturation.
Wow.
I mean, we're reaching at least 9 out of 10 of the families who are having new babies. And that's pretty incredible. You know, I've been working in poverty programs for a long time, and you often struggle with take up, that it's hard to reach families. You know, there's all these sort of articles on hard to find families and hard to serve. Like, how do we reach out to them? And in a matter of like 2 months, we've been able to reach virtually every family in the city of Flint who has a new baby. So one of the poorest cities in the nation. We have about 70% of the families are Black Flint residents. About 30% are white Flint residents. One really striking fact is that 60% of our families, that's 6 out of 10, are reporting household incomes below $10,000 a year. So that gives you a sense of sort of the resources. And when you think about this benefit, the impact that it could have when you're talking about really a significant increase to the overall resources that families have.
Of course, of course. And, you know, I think that's the best part about this program is from my reading of it and everything, when this was all starting to come out, I thought the best part was how it's not a means tested kind of program that people have to qualify for, or which means that, you know, or they don't have to be some type of like an income bracket or adhere to some type of work requirement. I mean, that's a key difference there, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a program about cash and about empowering families to have the money and be the experts on what their babies need and what their families need. Mm-hmm. It's also really about transforming the social contract, that so much of what we do in the safety net is ask lots and lots and lots of questions. Like, are you really deserving of this? Are you really low income? Do you really need help with food? Do you really need help with childcare? There's just this sort of principle that we want to make sure that no one who isn't eligible gets the help. The impact of this is the messages that it sends to families. It says, like, we don't trust you. We think you're trying to cheat the system.
Right.
We think you're lying. You said that you need help, but we don't believe you. So we're going to just really put you through the ringer. And this comes from a different logic, a different set of principles. That is, we know how hard it is to parent in this country, how expensive it is, and how important it is. We're talking about the next generation for the entire country. So we want to support you in that work in a way that lifts it up and lets you know you're not alone, that people care about you. And so RX Kids is a program that has got state money. You know, we got money from a block grant called Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, which was a huge thing, and I'm happy to talk about that more. It's money from philanthropy. It's money from the private industry and from local government, all coming together and trying to really communicate and use this program as a statement that we're going to transform the way we're doing business that really lifts families up instead of putting them down. And another really important aspect of the point that you just made is a lot of times when you have a line in the sand, you say, you know what, if you're above this income, you don't really need the help and we're not going to give you any. If you're below, we're going to make you prove it, but then we'll give it to you. That really creates a lot of animosity among families above the line,
yeah.
Right? Think about somebody who's just struggling to make ends meet at $30,000 a year, $35,000 a year, but they're watching the cost of what society thinks they need to take care of their kids, the cost of childcare. Yeah, you got to work, but then you got to spend on childcare and you got to spend on transportation. Or you should be buying books for your kids, all of these things. Like, these costs are a challenge for families well up the economic ladder. And so when we have programs that say, we're going to draw this line in the sand, say, hey, if you're above 20,000, you don't really need any help. It really creates animosity among families above that line, says, I'm still struggling too. And like, I'm trying to do everything by the rules. Why don't I get any help? And why do they get help? And so the goal of a program like this is to sort of target this benefit in a place that has very, very high poverty. Flint actually has the highest child poverty rate in the entire nation of every city in the entire country. Flint's got the highest child poverty rate. But at the same time, treat everyone there equally. And in doing so, we send just a very different message, and it can be uplifting and it can put everyone into sort of common cause rather than dividing everyone.
Right. It kind of takes away like any type of stigma or jealousy or whatever you would want to call it.
Exactly.
Yeah. I want to talk about the funding here in just a moment, but just want to go back to how you said that the original idea sort of came from that child tax credit that happened around the COVID period. And last fall, I spoke with Danielle Atkinson from Mothering Justice. Mm-hmm. About the child poverty rate, you know, how it had more than doubled last year from the previous year, because, of course, as you said, it did not get renewed. You had congressional Republicans, along with a couple of Democrats in the Senate, who just refused to extend that child tax credit. And like you said, I think it gave parents around $300, I think, a monthly check there. And I say that this is the part that made me feel maybe the most despair when it comes to federal policymakers, because the child tax credit for that 1 year provided solid data, as you've already talked about, showing how effective that it worked for millions and millions of families. So I'm going to ask you something similar that I asked Ms. Atkinson, if you don't mind here. Do you believe that one reason why programs such as the child tax credit, even though it showed that it worked, or programs such as RX Kids here in Flint, maybe one reason why they haven't taken off across the country is because we have been socialized to believe that in America, that government assistance is bad and that we just have to pull ourselves up from our bootstraps? I would just like your take on that.
Yeah, I think that's a part of it. There is this long history of a belief that if people get help, they're going to work less and then we're going to be struggling for workers. And one of the really interesting things is the huge growth in employment that we saw that was really started, really took off during that 2021 period, that we were able to do aid at a large level and also see people go back to work in stunning numbers. And sometimes we've heard employers complain, oh, there's no workers, no one wants to work. And the truth is, we are at some of the highest rates of people working in their prime working years that we ever have been in the history of recorded statistics going back to like the 1950s. There's more people in their working years actually at a job right now, as much as we've ever seen. One of the challenges is actually the population decline, that people for a long time have been having fewer babies. And so there are actually fewer workers around. And then we combine that with COVID really restricting immigration, meant that we just had a really tight labor market for a while, but people really did go back to work. And so it's interesting, you know, when you hear these sort of tropes come up again, oh, people just want to stay home when they get the aid. I mean, I could go back in time and you could find someone saying the exact same thing from a century ago, you know, with some other completely different sort of set of policies. It's just something we believe in, especially in this particular case, it's not true. One of the things about the design of the child tax credit was you get the same whether or not you work or not. And that's one thing we've seen is that with a lot of our public benefits, they decline as you go to work. And then there's a big challenge that people lose their public health insurance too if their earnings get too high. And so that really can trap people and cause them to sort of work less. And that's why we try to design things the way we design the expanded child tax credit to say, you know what, work, don't work, you get the same amount of money. And the evidence is really quite conclusive that there's a very small or no impact in reducing work when you design policy that way. The RX Kids program is really fascinating to me because I've been involved in these debates for a long time. And this one is getting a ton of attention in more conservative states. So we're talking with both advocates and policymakers in many states that people might consider red states who have a ton of interest in this. And I think some of the pieces are that it's targeted at that first year of life. So it really sort of circumvents this whole debate about whether or not people, it'll become a lifestyle or something, people stop working. And also, I think there's just broader agreement that, you know, it's just really hard to have a baby. It's a lot of work and we should do something for parents. And a lot of interest in that prenatal period too, which is really evidence-based that the more we can do for pregnant people in the months before they give birth, the better off they will be and the better off their children will be.
Right. Because, I mean, I think maybe if there are critics out there when it comes to these programs, they refuse, I think, to acknowledge that, for instance, with the RX Kids program and similar programs that are happening in other countries. I mean, this is happening in other countries. For example, as you know, I'm sure like our neighbors to the north in Canada, they've tried similar cash transfer programs to families, and studies there have shown that programs are leading to fewer premature births, better cognitive development.
Right.
So again, I guess it just seems like this is kind of common sense policy idea that we should be trying. And I'm actually kind of optimistic that you just said that there are some conservative states that are actually states that we tend to look at nationally as conservative states, or at least policymakers, that they're even looking at something like what's happening with RX Kids.
Yeah. You know, as I said, I've been in this space for a long time. And what you said before that was absolutely right, that there's a huge evidence base that this is good for families, this is good for babies, and that can pay lifelong dividends from all over the world. And so it's really honestly in a different space than guaranteed income proposals, which I think are important to be talking about. But still, we have to figure out exactly how they should be rolled out, in my view. But These types of programs, child benefits, and especially for young children in that prenatal period, the evidence base is super, super strong. I have really been taken aback by the interest in this program from across the political divide. There's just more people who, you know, when we're talking about that first year of life, when we're talking about the prenatal period, I think are enthusiastic about this than I've seen in other cases. And that's really exciting to me.
Dr. Schaefer, since you brought this up just a little earlier, so let's go back to it. Where does the funding for Rx Kids come from? Like, is it a mix of public and private funding?
Yeah, this is one of the really beautiful things. We started out with an incredible challenge grant from the C.S. Mott Foundation. They came in on board with $15 million to support Rx Kids, which was just amazing, you know, set the trajectory. But they said, you got to raise another $15 million before we're going to give it. And we've had a huge amount of luck with just all sorts of different funders. And I'm so grateful to all of them. But one of the big game changers was with the state of Michigan. So all states have a block grant called Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, or TANF. That's a block grant that states get to provide a cash assistance program. It was actually born out of the 1996 welfare law. And when it first came into being, we all thought that this was a new welfare to work program with time limits and where states would have to have a certain number of people on their caseload working. But what states figured out over the decades was that it was an incredibly flexible funding stream, that they could provide cash assistance to families. And if they did, they had to abide by these time limits and the work requirements, and they had to do a ton of reporting. Or there were these other purposes of TANF, like promoting marriage and reducing out-of-marriage births. And if they said that what they were spending on was one of these, you know, was fitting into one of those goals, they pretty much had no accountability at all. They just had to say it was true. And what states further figured out they could do is move their TANF dollars into things like their foster care system, child welfare, and then move the state general fund from there to other things. So it essentially became a unrestricted funding stream. And policymakers from Barack Obama to Paul Ryan have proposed that we tighten this up, you know, argued that that was not what anybody intended. But we haven't had a lot of luck in getting states to sort of go back to helping families. And I think that's in large part because the TANF program, the cash assistance program, is really stigmatized. But yeah. Rx Kids was able to use a provision in TANF, for the wonks out there, called non-recurrent short-term benefits, NRST, that allows you to provide cash aid to families during an acute economic crisis for a limited number of months. And we define childbirth as the acute economic crisis because that is actually when poverty spikes to the highest in the life course. And so we were able to get $3.3 million a year with TANF dollars to support Rx Kids in Flint. And now I'm so excited that Governor Whitmer included $24 million to expand it to other cities in her executive budget. So this is an incredibly important time to see if we can get that money included in the final budget. It's a great time to call legislators or call the governor and tell them how excited you are about Rx Kids and why you think it's good policy.
That was going to be my next question. I mean, Rx Kids is happening in Flint, but the goal, right, is to get this going in other areas of the state, right?
Yeah, we're super excited about the possibility of expansion. Incredible advocates in Kalamazoo are already lining up and ready to go. We've been talking with folks in the Eastern Upper Peninsula. City government in Dearborn is super excited about it. And so we hope, again, that this money from TANF is allocated to expand it to other cities and that we see it expand to other cities. Could be as early as next January, which is pretty incredible. We're busy raising the additional philanthropic dollars. You can't just do this with TANF money. You have to have other sources too. It has to be a public-private partnership for a variety of reasons. So incredible to already be thinking about scaling it up. Exciting to see where it's going to expand to first.
You know, we've been focusing on how this program, you know, will help, obviously, families, help expecting moms and their babies. But I've also got to believe, if you don't mind if I kind of take it this way, I've got to believe that the business community is also kind of charting this kind of program because they would also stand to benefit from this as well, right?
Yeah. So one of the things we see with the expanded child tax credit, we have a lot of information about where people spent that money. A lot of it gets spent in local economies. We actually think of Rx Kids in Flint as both a social welfare and health program. but also an economic development program where we're expecting to see millions and millions of new dollars flowing through the Flint economy. So we're really excited about that and thinking about ways to analyze that. And we saw that with the child tax credit, that people spent it on staples, they spent it at the grocery store, they paid down debts. If you had told me that we could have a policy that both helped families put food on the table and help them improve their credit scores, like that's just unbelievable. But where does that money get spent? It does. It gets spent at local retailers a lot. And so, companies like Dollar General were huge proponents of the expanded child tax credit. And we hope to see the same type of support in local communities across Michigan.
Finally, what do you think we'll be saying about the RX Kids program in Flint in a couple of years? And how do you think it'll, change the perceptions of policymakers everywhere in the future when it comes to a universal payment program such as RX Kids, and how they can begin to view such programs as, I'd say, like investments rather than spending initiatives?
I'll say two things. The first is that I expect we're going to see RX Kids spread to other communities all across Michigan. And within a couple of years, I expect to see it spread across the country. And we could see it in different cities across the country, or maybe some states will do it as a whole state. I am excited because Flint has such a huge and proud history of being a leader to the nation. And they were a leader in bringing cars and automobiles to the world. First subdivision was actually built in Flint. Huge strides for organized labor. And so this is an exciting program that I think takes a city which has had hard times and is often known for crisis and poverty. And it offers a very different vision that, like, Flint is now a leader to all of us in how we should care for our youngest children. And everybody should be trying to follow the example that Flint has offered. So that's really cool. And, the final thing I think is I have visions of something like this, not just expanding across the country, but expanding across the world. Like, the evidence is just so clear that if we're going to invest in any age across the lifespan, we should be doing more for families with new kids and babies in that first year. And that lesson goes not just in the United States, but all across the world. So imagine a world where we eradicate infant poverty as a species. And that's a pretty exciting vision to me. And I've done some back of the envelope math, and it's not out of reach. It's something we could do. And cash transfers like this are programs that it's possible to administer without depending on local governments all of the time too. So to me, the potential for growth of this is incredibly exciting, and the potential for a Michigan movement, a national movement, and actually a worldwide movement make me so excited it's hard to sleep.
Transforming the Social Contract.
There you go.
With Dr. H. Luke Schaefer, co-director of RX Kids. And Dr., real quick, you mentioned a book that you wrote earlier here in the interview. Can you just say it one more time for our listeners?
Yeah, sure. I've got two books. The first is called $2 a Day, Living on Almost Nothing in America. That's a book I wrote with Kathy Eden in 2015. And she and I and our collaborator Tim Nelson just came out with a new book called The Injustice of Place. So $2 a Day was about very poor families, and The Injustice of Place is about very, very poor communities and the histories, understanding how that came to be. So they're both good stocking stuffers. They're great birthday gifts. So, if folks are interested, I hope they check them out.
All right. Outstanding. Dr. Schaefer, thank you so much for coming on here this week. And I'd love to have you back again sometime, and good luck to you.
Sounds good, Pat. Thank you.
You're listening to Left of Lansing. If the podcast isn't enough and you are in need of more Pat, follow him on Twitter and like him on Facebook. Also, don't forget, you can read more of his thoughts and hear an archive of past episodes on leftoflansing.com.
Again, the RX Kids program simply makes common sense. I'd like to thank Dr. H. Luke Schaefer for being on here again this week. In fact, let's use RX Kids in Flint as the basis for the weekly Left of Lansing online poll. The question is, would you like to see the RX Kids program expanded to other areas of the state of Michigan? Your answers are yes, no, I don't know. Just search for my handle on Twitter or X to vote on the poll that's at Left of Lansing. Time now for a Left of Lansing last call. My talk there with Dr. Schaefer just illustrates how we can really invest in people if we want to do it. I mean, if we truly want to do it. Yes, he said it takes both private and public funding for a program like this, and because it's a no-string-attached kind of program, it takes out the onerous rules and regulations, thereby ensuring that local and state governments won't need to fill those extra positions for a means-tested program. I know, crazy. In an article about the RX Kids program I read in Michigan Advance this week, Dr. Schaefer said, if you're about small government, then you'll like this program. Well, yeah. I mean, one reason is because of how it doesn't contain all those stupid requirements to be eligible. I always think that when it comes to some policymakers, it's all about making things more difficult for hardworking people. Look, Governor Whitmer's budget last year did include some money for the RX Kids program, but of course, there were some Republicans who had to vote against it. For example, right-wing crank Jim Runstead told Bridge Magazine that the Flint program without restrictions are emotional programs, which create a dependence on government. And the crank also said, to just willy-nilly hand checks out is irresponsible to the nth degree. But as Dr. Schaefer points out, this isn't handing out checks in perpetuity to people. It's about helping people deal with poverty while having a baby. It builds trust within the community, and it helps the local economy, as well as helping a child during that very important first year of life. I mean, come on, everyone. For years, in both Democratic and Republican administrations, we had no problem dishing out billions of dollars in corporate subsidies, which, as we learned last week here in Michigan, it's not exactly doing what they promised. We have no problems giving handouts to corporations. Oh, we love that. But we also love putting stringent demands on struggling, hardworking families. Oh yeah, that's our hobby here in this country. RX Kids doesn't do that. It doesn't take away opportunity. It expands opportunity for those who most need it. The RX Kids program in Flint is a pro-children, pro-family, and yes, a pro-life program.
You're listening to the Left of Lansing podcast. The music you're hearing is by Wander Beats. To hear the latest project, check out Space Leopard on your favorite streaming site. Now back to our favorite progressive voice in Michigan, it's Pat Johnston.
That'll do it for this installment of The Left of Lansing. Please make sure to subscribe to Left of Lansing wherever you get your podcast and give it a 5-star review, and also subscribe to leftoflansing.com. Hey, next week, my guest will be the incomparable Amanda Marcotte from Salon.com. Looking forward to that one. So that's next week's show. As for our beloved Detroit Red Wings, hey, you guys at least made it interesting and fun this week. So here's to making the postseason next season, Hockey Town. Until next week, remember, take the battle to them. Thank you, Michigan.
The Left of Lansing podcast was produced by Pat Johnston, written by Pat Johnston, researched by Pat Johnston, edited by Pat Johnston, and hosted by, yes, Pat Johnston. Technical assistance by Dr. Heather. And thanks to our good friend Kirsten for the awesome podcast logo. Remember to visit leftoflansing.com for more news and information. Thanks again for listening to the Left of Lansing podcast.